talk about my work in sort of characterizing the initial boundary value problem in numeric relativity. This is a talk that I've refined for the Midwest Relativity meeting. In that meeting, the talk was 10 minutes plus two for questions, and the entire thing was aimed towards essentially relativists and numeric relativists. So I'm going to try to spend a lot more time sort of explaining where this stuff comes from and background and stuff like that. So feel free to ask questions during the talk, and I'll try to fill in some of this stuff. So the first thing that I want to talk about is black hole echoes. This is an idea that's been thrown around for quite a while. And essentially what it is a sort of agnostic way to think about detecting deviations from GR, especially quantum gravity. So essentially the idea is near the horizon of a black hole, you have you sort of approach this quantum gravity limit, and in vanilla GR, there's nothing special about the event horizon. You throw some gravitational waves or radiation or whatever into the horizon, it just crosses the horizon, that's fine. But the idea behind black hole echoes is that there may be some change in sort of that quantum gravity limit that would lead to some effective reflection off of interface before it reaches the horizon. So you may end up with these sort of reflecting or echoes of gravitational waves or matter waves or anything like this. So what people have been looking for is these this sort of echo of a gravitational wave signal, sort of finite time away from the LIGO signal, for example.
I didn't actually put the microphone on. So I don't know if anyone in Zoom is actually hearing me or not. Yeah, okay. It's not a big deal.
I guess, do you want to record it?
I mean, I don't particularly care, but we can just... There we go. Testing.
So that's the idea, is that you may end up with this sort of effective reflection near the interface of the event horizon. And what people have done is try to simulate this in linearized gravity, and if sort of phenomenologically, but nobody had done this in numeric relativity. In fact, what a reflection even means is a sort of nebulous concept in GR. So what we were trying to do is see if we can sort of define what this means and to properly implement it. And to do that, we sort of started in spherical symmetry as the sort of easiest case. And we had to sort of employ a lot of sort of state-of-the-art numerical methods. So I'm going to talk about how a lot of these are sort of employed. But the general idea to make simulations stable for an initial a completely arbitrary initial boundary value problem, what you want is to first put your system of equations in a symmetric hyperbolic form. And effectively what that means is that regardless of the system that you're solving, there is some notion of a numerical energy that is conserved. And if you can show that there is a numerical energy that's conserved, then you can effectively prove that the problem that you're solving is stable over some time scale. The other thing that we want to employ is something called summation by parts operators. And what these operators do is they ensure that if there is a conserved energy or numerical energy, then if you use these operators, you can prove that that energy is conserved over all time. And then another thing that we implement is a special boundary conditions. It's called summation or simultaneous approximation terms. But effectively what you do is you add an exponential decay term to your evolution equations that applies the boundary conditions. And in that in that fashion, it's a weak implementation, as opposed to enforcing them exactly at the boundaries. And so that helps with stability quite a bit. And then specific to GR, people have come up with these constraint damping and constraint preserving boundary conditions that really help numerical relativity simulations. So I want to sort of walk through how to think about this kind of stuff. So in linearized gravity, gravity is just a bunch of scalar wave equations. So it's really instructive to think about the scalar wave equation and how to do that in an initial boundary value problem. So the scalar wave equation has the sort of generalized Dill-Embersen operator. And the idea that to try to cast this in a symmetric hyperbolic form is you try to make a first-order system of equations rather than one second-order equation like is written there. So you define something that holds the time derivative, which is this capital pi, and something that holds the space derivative. This is lowercase psi. And then when you sort of write down your system of equations, you might get some sort of complicated thing, but it has a particular structure. And the structure is you have an evolution equation for each one of these individual variables. And when you run a characteristic analysis on this sort of system, you find that there are characteristics. And these characteristics are some linear combination of the variables you've defined. And in one dimension, like I'm doing here for in spherical symmetry, you have one mode that, say, moves to the left or to the left, and one mode that moves to the right. And that's given by these sort of characteristic speeds. And so once you have identified the characteristic modes and speeds, you can write down conservation laws and figure out what boundary conditions you should have. So in this particular case, we're going to think about a static scalar field on a sort of stack, or a scalar field, dynamic scalar field on a static background. And in that case, we have a conserved quantity due to the presence of a time-like Killing vector. And you can write this conserved quantity as effectively some time derivative of some energy. And that's equal to some flux through the boundaries. In spherical symmetry, there's just two essentially point-like boundaries since we're in effective one dimension. And so you're essentially restricting to a domain from R equals A to R equals B. And this represents your flux through those two boundaries. So you can sort of read off what you expect the boundary conditions to be depending on how much energy you want to leave or enter the domain. So in this case, what the degree of freedom we have to choose is this U plus. And so we sort of define a boundary condition that looks like this. And what that does is if this K, which is some arbitrary constant, is 0, or is plus or minus 1, then this whole side vanishes. And so you get exact energy conservation. And in that sense, you can define what it means to reflect something. If a scalar field comes into the boundary and this flux term is 0, then the energy is conserved exactly, and so you get this sort of reflecting off of the boundary. So let's look at some simulations of exactly doing this. The top part plot has to do with the convergence of the simulation. So this just shows you I'm getting fourth order convergence, so the simulation is good. But the actual solution is shown here. So what I'm doing is this is in spherical symmetry from R equals 3 to R equals 8 at the top here. And then this is time on the x-axis here. And so what you see is that the scalar field initially starts at radius 6. And it's initially moving in towards the origin. And it reflects back and forth. I have a different style of boundary condition on the top versus the bottom. In this one, it retains the sign. In this one, it switches the sign. But on both, they're exactly conservative in the sense that I talked about in the previous slide. And so because this is a static flat background, the scalar field moves on straight lines. And so it just goes back and forth the entire way. And so that's what we expect out of a flat background sort of simulation. But when we instead add a static black hole background, things change a little bit. So now the characteristic speeds are no longer plus or minus one. And in this one, I'm using Kerr shield coordinates. So only one of the speeds is affected. And so you can see that just like in the previous one, you have this sort of straight line moving down towards the inside since the characteristic speed is still minus one. But when it reflects back, you get this sort of, looks like a sort of acceleration as it moves out. And that's because the scalar field has to climb out of the gravitational potential. So this is effectively what it looks like to simulate this sort of scalar field without the dynamics of numerical relativity. So now if we want the background to become dynamic, we have more details to sort of constrain. So when we want to have the sort of dynamic background, we have to figure out what it means to reflect something on a dynamic background. In spherical symmetry, you have you just so happen to have a quantity called the Meissner-Sharp mass that we can help to define this. And so I'm going to think about the amount of Meissner-Sharp mass in my domain. So the black hole has a certain amount of mass, but the Meissner-Sharp mass within the domain is just the mass of the scalar field itself in the domain itself. And it just so happens that in spherical symmetry, this is locally conserved, and this is not true in general, but just a fact of spherical symmetry. So you write down, this is effectively, this relation comes from the Einstein constraints, but you define this sort of Meissner-Sharp energy in the domain, and you find that it has a sort of flux term very similar to the scalar field case that we had before. So you can try to define a boundary condition that controls this flux term. For example, you might want it to vanish. And if you have it vanish, then that effectively means that the Meissner-Sharp mass within the domain remains constant. And so you can have this sort of reflecting problem, just like we had before. So what you do is you choose a boundary condition. The degree of freedom we have to choose is this U plus, for example. And you choose something very similar to what we did before with some arbitrary constant here. And if this arbitrary constant is plus or minus one, then this entire flux term vanishes and you get exact conservation of the Meissner-Sharp mass within the domain. Now we set, and so in the GR sector, we have two other degrees of freedom that we have to choose. One is labeled this U plus theta, and the other is labeled this U plus R. And those sort of tell you the degrees of freedom of the GRR component of the metric and the G theta theta component of the metric. These ones are arbitrary, and this mode actually controls the position of the boundary itself. Because now that the background is dynamic, your boundaries can also be dynamic. There's nothing to prevent your boundaries from moving around. And this U plus theta it controls the Meissner-Sharp mass based on the actual definition of the Meissner-Sharp mass. So here's the mass that you want it to be at the boundary. And if you set this to be plus or minus one, this mass is just some constant at the boundary. So let's see what happens when we do this. This is an example of the full relativistic initial boundary value problem in spherical symmetry. And what we've done is we've had, just like before, I have one sign of the boundary condition that switches the sign on the inside and keeps the sign on the outside. So you have just the scalar field bouncing back and forth in the domain. The top two plots have to do with the numerical convergence. So this just shows our simulation is working. But the two bottom plots show you what's actually happening. So you have the scalar field come down on the inside, bounce back and forth within the domain. And then this shows the Meissner-Sharp mass. You can see how initially the Meissner-Sharp mass is this blue value, which is one. and it stays this blue value as the scalar field moves back and forth to show you that that's actually what is happening, is we're actually setting this Meissner-Sharp mass to be conserved at the boundaries. So there are two important GR effects that are present here. The first is there's an extra dispersion of the field, and that's because the mass of the space-time changes over the width of the scalar field itself. So what you get is an effective dispersion of the pulse, and so it gets wider and wider as things move on. The other very big change compared to the static field case is the boundaries are moving. They're dynamic. And so what I have plotted here is the aerial radius, which is a quantity that tells you physically where the boundary is compared to the Schwarzschild black hole itself. And so you can see that initially it's at aerial radius 8m, and then as time moves on, this boundary actually sinks towards the horizon. Same thing with the inner boundary, it actually sinks in towards the horizon. So the boundary conditions that we've chosen happen to have this sort of sinking effect. And so this is just an example of the full initial boundary value problem and how you might go about simulating black hole echoes on some interface before the horizon. The sort of whole point of this is to show that you can actually do this sort of thing. So yeah, this is what's going on here. Another thing that we sort of wanted to show is that the energy conservation in each one of these three cases. So you can see that flat spherical Minkowski case has this sort of energy conservation. As I increase the resolution, this is increased resolution, the energy is conserved to better and better tolerances. And the operators that we are using just so happen to make this sink at a rate of a sixth order rate. Then once you start having the simulation be around a static background, it moves up but still has the same rate of energy conservation. And then as the dynamic case sort of sits and then sort of deviates slightly as things move on. So we're essentially just showing that you can, in fact, numerically conserve this sort of energy and this Meissner-Sharp mass in this simulation. And then one of the sort of physical things that we wanted to show is that you can actually reflect something before it gets swallowed by an apparent horizon. So in all these simulations, I have a boundary that's sitting outside of the event horizon initially. But the apparent horizon is some sort of dynamic thing. It can move around, and in fact, it can move into my domain. So if I have a boundary that sinks underneath an apparent horizon, then there's no sense of reflecting anything anymore. It's essentially all my characteristics have to fall into the apparent horizon. So there was some skepticism in the community that you could even reflect anything at all if there's a surface near the event horizon, because the apparent horizon is going to come and swallow the waves before that can happen. And what we're essentially showing is that if you put a boundary there and you have it be transmitting versus reflecting, how much mass can you reflect just before you get the case where the apparent horizon moves into the domain? And what this plot is showing is that you can get more reflection with reflecting boundary conditions than you can with transmitting ones. So there should be some sort of empirically experimental way of telling the difference between having some sort of reflecting surface there than not having one in the first place. So in principle, this sort of lays credence to the fact that you might have black hole echoes be detectable. I've been trying to generalize this to higher dimensions. This is an example in axial symmetry rather than spherical symmetry. And what this plot is showing is I have the z coordinate here. I have like a Schwarzschild black hole in the middle here. And what I'm, the region that I'm actually running is sort of a spherical volume section. And so what I'm going to sort of inject is a plane gravitational wave. And that plane gravitational wave is going to sort of scatter along this boundary that surrounds the black hole. And so let's see if that will actually work. Please. Oh, that's strange. I believe in you. Well, this worked before, and now it's not working. Oh, it's because this is not the right viewer. Let's see if we can get it to work in this one. Ah, there we go. What is this, like, control H?
You see that okay?
Yeah. So now this is outside of the realm of spherical symmetry, but now I can, you know, essentially, in spherical symmetry, there's no gravitational waves. So we had to put a scalar field in there in order to get things to sort of work. But now, in axial symmetry, you can actually have gravitational waves. So you can throw plane gravitational waves against a reflecting surface. And so this is a simulation of this. And you can sort of see that there's a black hole here because the null rays get sort of swept around the actual thing here. So it just so happened in spherical symmetry that there was a local conservation law, even in dynamic GR. But in general, in GR, there's no such thing as energy conservation. Instead, what you have is what they call quasi-local conservation laws. And so what that looks like is a little bit different than the kind of conservation laws that we're used to from killing symmetries. So effectively, what quasi-local conservation laws do is they relate a global quantity on a surface to a flux through that surface. So rather than a volume integral over a bunch of field, instead you're doing a surface integral over that and relating it to the flux through that surface. And so in that sense, it's quasi-local rather than local. And so what we can do is we can base what we're calling a reflection off of these quasi-local conservation laws. And so that's effectively what we're trying to do now. And then as time moves on, hopefully I can get this to work in the same fashion that I've gotten the other things to work. So just to quickly summarize, so we're sort of applying a lot of state-of-the-art numerical methods to try to get these sort of initial boundary value problems to work in GR. And we're sort of modeling black hole echoes. And what's nice about this is that we can sort of model, the idea behind this is to model deviations from GR in a sort of agnostic way. So I give you the ability to put reflecting boundary conditions around black holes, and then quantum gravitationalists can then tell me, hey, I expect X amount of reflection from my theory, and then I can go and run this on a computer and show you exactly what gravitational wave echo you should expect, and then we can sort of do that sort of limitation thing with actual data. And so what I'm trying to work on now is generalizations to 3D, and we also want to better understand how to affect the actual movement of dynamical boundaries. So yeah, that's it. I successfully managed to turn a 10-minute presentation into a 25-minute one.
Well, there you go.
Of course he did.
Yeah. I have a question.
So on your app feed for video definition, so it's structured, right?
So it's a Schwarzschild black hole. In this particular case, it's a static Schwarzschild black hole. But
and so the outer boundary is not, it's just the baby's brain, that domain that you're showing.
So like the outer boundary is sort of transparent.
Okay.
And so waves just sort of propagate through it. But then the inner boundary is reflecting.
The reason that I'm asking, the bottom, the babies getting swallowed, is that the reason that they're getting some babies at the horizon, or your inner reflecting boundary? See what?
This is the inner reflecting boundary, right?
Yeah, but why the babe? Is it because of the gravity swallowing the babe that we are getting babes there?
So the null geodesics sweep around this way, and then some of them get thrown onto the boundary again, but you might see that they actually reflect off of that as well. But you have to realize that there's a lot of complicated stuff going on just because the speed that goes out this way is less than the speed it takes to go in, and so things will propagate slower as they move away. There's a little bit of like reflection coming out when it smashes against the reflecting surface. At least that's the idea of what should be happening, I think. Yeah, coordinate speed, yeah. Yeah, everything here is moving at the speed of light, but the coordinate speed is different in different directions. And so that's when you actually look at the simulation, it looks like things are moving slower or faster. When in reality, everything's moving on a null geodesic.
Yeah, and the scenario you keep in mind is that you have like a binary, right? And then like it emits gravitational waves, and some of them just hit another black hole, right? And sort of reflect and go away again, right? Is that?
Yeah, so like in vanilla GR, you say have a set of gravitational waves that are going towards infinity, and then a set of gravitational waves that end at a black hole singularity. And the difference when you add a reflecting surface is now some of those ingoing waves now reach infinity at some later finite time from the original burst. And how big that echo of the signal will look and what time it actually reaches there are sort of free parameters depending on where you put your reflecting surface and how reflecting it is. But effectively, the goal would be to like put a boundary outside of these merging black holes and have it reflect waves. But the best of that case that people do is they put boundaries on the inside of the apparent horizon. And that's convenient because you want to excise the singularity, and then you can do these sort of numerical simulations by just sort of excising the interior of the black hole. But what I want to do is effectively put a boundary right outside the apparent horizon, which is annoyingly a lot more complicated because you effectively don't have to worry about the boundary value problem if you have it on the inside of the horizon, because there's no characteristics coming into the domain. They're all going towards the singularity outside of the domain. But once you have it outside, you have to consider all the full boundary value problem, which numerical relativists tend to ignore a lot of times because it's annoying and difficult. So I'm trying to change that.
Sorry, like what's causing these reflections? Like, is it some property of the black hole? Or?
So it would be a property of some quantum gravity phenomenon. So like the easiest, the sort of phenomenological way of thinking about it is like you have a soup of Hawking radiation particles near the horizon. And so it's like you have a bunch of null rays and then they hit a sort of interface where they're moving slower, like a physical interface. And then that leads to some reflection, some transmission. That's not actually what's happening, likely, when you write down like some field equations or whatever, but it's like a phenomenological way of thinking about it. And then depending on your actual gravitational or your actual quantum gravity theory, that might sort of modify what a Schwarzschild black hole looks like near the horizon, just in general. And thinking of having a sort of reflecting interface there is a sort of agnostic way of sort of modeling these sort of theories near the horizon.
Do we expect these reflecting surfaces also to be dynamical in those theories?
That's a good question, and that's something I would like to answer. Because not only do is there not a good understanding in numerical relativity of how to deal with these sort of dynamic boundaries, there's also not a good understanding of what quantum gravity would constrain those things to do. Because like people think about this sort of phenomenological problem, and they think, okay, I can do this sort of linearized gravity thing and see these sort of reflecting waves, but where the boundary actually remains, say near the apparent horizon or something, is something that's not well understood, I don't think. And so this is something that people have to sort of figure out, i.e. me.
I have two quick questions. One,
good question.
There is no structure in your boundary, right? In a sense that it's not frequency dependent, for example. You're just saying it's reflecting.
Yeah, so my sort of definition of reflection has to do with conservation laws. It doesn't have anything to do with the frequency of waves or the particular model you throw against it. That's the way I have come to think about it. You might be able to do different things, but to me, the best way to define what a reflection means is to think about a conservation law. So that's the sort of starting point that I've taken on most of these approaches.
Conservation gives you the energy, but if you are thinking about the wave and some characteristics to talk about some physical quantity, right? You need the frequency, and you need to know how it's reflecting different frequencies. The second question is that if you want to consider these reflecting boundaries to be from some quantum gravity conjectures, I think they should be very close to like a Planck scale.
Yeah.
To the horizon, right? So that we could see those kind of effects.
Mm-hmm.
So where is your boundary? And what?
So this particular simulation just happens to be fairly far from the horizon. Like the horizon here is 2m, and the boundary is at 5m. So this one is far away. The usual phenomenological thing with quantum gravity is you imagine that there's a Planck scale sort of interface from the horizon. And we talked about in our previous paper how difficult that would be to simulate. It's mostly a resolution thing. And it becomes very, very difficult. But at least in spherical symmetry, you have a scale to choose. So I picked, I did a simulation of a reflecting surface that was 2.01m from the initial 2m of the horizon. And if you imagine that the black hole scale was Planck scale to begin with, then that's pretty close to Planck scale. If you wanted to have, say, solar mass scale black hole, and you wanted to do this sort of simulation, it'd be very difficult to achieve numerically. So that is certainly an issue in simulating this kind of stuff.
It's a problem even if you use some ingoing Finkelstein coordinates where you have no like apparent singularity of the horizon yet. Doesn't matter.
So the problem is the following: you have in spherical symmetry, I've got my R equals A, and this is like my horizon. It's pretty close, and I have a pulse that looks like this, and it goes in. What happens when this reflects is it starts going this way, but it ends up very thin. And this is just an artifact of conserving energy when the characteristic speed is very small near the horizon itself. In order to keep energy constant,
you have to have a very thin pulse if it's moving very slowly, sort of like to sort of trade it off. And if you have it very, very close, this becomes effectively a delta function. And the problem is in resolving that numerically. So if you want to have your functions on a grid, then you have to have very fine resolution here. Now, there are some tricks you can play. Like you can try to put a lot of grid points very close to the horizon and not so much later on. So you can sort of play around with this kind of stuff. But that's the actual problem numerically, is that you're at least in certain other coordinate systems it might be better, but the problem is the difference in characteristic speeds, the one going in versus the one going out. It'd be cool if like you could come up with a weird coordinate system where like they were the same at the boundary, but I bet that this pulse effectively would have to be the same width, and I bet it would have to get really thin before it reached the horizon and then reflect very thin and then change as it moves out. But yeah, there's some tricks you could play, I'm sure.
Someone online just wondering if you have a reference for this work.
Sure. Did I not have one at the end? Maybe I did. I guess I didn't. So I mean, the title of this talk is exactly the title of the paper that all of these plots can be found in. I guess I didn't put an archive number on here.
Oh, that's great.
All right.